Hello all. Before we settle into this edition of the Books Podcast, I wanted to tell you more about our sponsor, Squarespace. Create a beautiful website or online store with one of Squarespace's award-winning templates. It'll display perfectly on your Kindle, iPad, desktop, whatever. Head to squarespace.com/guardian and enter the offer code GuardianBooksPod to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single podcast in possession of a good set of presenters must be in want of a fantastic subject. And it is with that in mind that we doff our bonnets, arrange ourselves on the settle, and begin our Jane Austen special. It was 200 years ago this year that a 41-year-old woman called Jane died quietly with her head in the lap of her older sister, completely unaware that her writing would become synonymous with the very greatest of British literature. But two centuries on, how do we make her writing relevant to young audiences, and how much do we know of the woman herself? Historian Lucy Worsley joins us later in the podcast to talk about her research into the importance of home to Austen and her literary heroines. But first, with me in the studio is one of those young people, Sian. We had a bit of a doodah, didn't we, Sian, trying to work out that very first sentence because you didn't know what a settle was. And
no.
I was insisting that we should have a settle in the intro because it is a Regency object of furniture, very highly relevant to Lucy Worsley.
Well, I always just imagine sort of various far too rigid chairs or poofs and things that are sort of scattered around, artfully around a front room where you can arrange your ribbons or whatever the hell women used to do.
Well, indeed, a settle is a sort of Regency sofa. But I don't think you were
very
really,
uncomfortable.
You weren't expected to be comfortable. And also you had to have things that would support that funny little bustle you had at the back. If they indeed had a bustle, because we also this led to a bit of research into what they wore, didn't it? And people think of them as wearing crinolines, but they didn't wear crinolines.
Well, yes. This afternoon has revealed Claire Armitstead to be a crinoline expert of The Guardian.
Well, a pedant, more like.
Because we had a script where it said something about crinoline and you were like, well, they didn't wear crinoline. I was like, didn't they? I just assumed they did. They've got big foofy skirts.
As it happened, crinolines came in later in the 19th century. Anyway, enough, brat. I'm going to now ask you who your favourite Austen character is, which your favourite novel is.
Oh, that's good, actually. Well, I speaking of brats, I quite like all the brats in Austen novels. I quite like sort of the young sort of rascals that turn up, like Willoughby and Wickham.
The bounders, I think.
Yeah,
you'll find
the bad boys of Austen. I like them, but I also really love Colonel Brandon, and I like Captain Wentworth as well. I think it's the sort of older man thing that they sort of stand around looking a bit miserable, and at the end they have a happy ending.
Yeah, they're also the ones that the naughty girls that must have had much more fun. And I remember somebody writing rather wonderfully in review at one point for The Guardian that Lizzie Bennet's younger sister probably had very good sex and continued to have it.
Yeah, Wickham probably knew what he was doing, right?
exactly. So, but anyway, you carefully dodged the main question, which is your favourite novel?
Persuasion. Actually, interestingly, this week, because we have the reading group online on the Guardian Books website, and basically we pick a book each month, and then we sort of talk it over, and we knew because it was the bicentenary this month for Austen that we'd do Jane Austen this month, and I was kind of suspecting that maybe it'd be Pride and Prejudice, maybe Sense and Sensibility, but they picked Persuasion, and that made me really happy, and everyone sort of came up with the same reason, saying that it feels like the most mature, but also the most personal of all of her books. It feels like there's a lot of her in there, even though you can't really identify what it might be, because she's a bit of a mystery, really, certainly in terms of her romantic life. We don't really know what was going on in her head. And I just love Persuasion, and there were people were quoting bits in the comments, and someone wrote the bit from one of Wentworth's letter at the very end where he's confessing how much he loves Anne, and he writes, "You pierce my soul," and I just had a little pang in my chest at my desk because I was like, oh God, it's so beautiful.
And also on the front of the Guardian review, we did a feature roundup of The Great and the Good,
yes,
nominating their favourites, and it's quite interesting some of the things they said.
Yeah, well, I mean, your favourite is Emma.
Yes.
And Joyce Carol Oates wrote about Emma. And she has quite interesting things to say about when you should read it, at what point in your life.
I think she's wrong. She says it's best read at 20, about the same age as Emma is. But I don't think you could get Emma at that age, because the point about Emma is she's such an unreliable narrator. She's such a minx and a hussy and a bossy boots and all those. She's just sort of wonderfully imperfect. I think you have to be a bit older to get that.
Yeah. Do you actually like Emma in Emma, or do you just like the book? Because she's quite unlikable.
Oh, I like her in the book, and I like the book. Mm. I mean, I love Jane Austen said she was going to take a heroine whom nobody but herself would much like. Mm. And I just think that that's a wonderfully novelistic thing to do. You know, you put her at the centre of the novel and then actually give her a sort of development and a spiritedness that actually does make you like her. I think she's wonderful. Mm. And she makes all the mistakes that we all make, and so I think the psychology is very modern, and also Clueless, which is the film based on Emma, is one of my Christmas year film. Yeah, it's Clueless. It's absolutely glorious.
Do you have the same thing that I think a lot of people have, because you watch Clueless and it's set in the modern days, that when she gets with her sort of stepbrother, that there is still something about it that makes you get a little bit creeped out? Because it was kind of in Regency days, everyone was your cousin and you all got married to each other. But when it's sort of put in the modern times, you're like, oh, yeah. I don't know about this.
It's properly uncomfortable in the way that actually Emma is uncomfortable. And I'm a great one for uncomfortable reads. I've always give me an uncomfortable read. Give me a settle any day over a modern day sofa. Anyway, you may remember Sarah Pascoe as the comedian and writer whose book Animal we featured on the podcast 2 years ago. This time she's turned her laser wit to Austen and a stage adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Richard Lee went out and about to find her doing some work in one of London's most auspicious literary hideouts.
So I'm here in the British Library with Sarah Pascoe, who's been hard at work adapting Jane Austen's 1816 novel Pride and Prejudice for the stage. So how did the project begin, Sarah? Where did the idea come from?
Well, Jane Austen wrote a book a very long time ago, so let's credit her with the main idea. And then, obviously, it's 2017 now, so we're just past the bicentennial, I believe they call it. And so there's been lots of Austen revivals and projects, and one of those was that the Nottingham Playhouse wanted to have a version of Pride and Prejudice on stage. And they felt that a lot of the existing versions were very, while being very traditional, maybe, this is not their words, this is my words, boring, dull, flat, and they had engaged Susanna Trezillian to direct, and she's, by coincidence, my housemate, so does show business work. It's who you live with, it's who you're going, oh my God, are they doing Pride and Prejudice and they need a new writer? So I got the job. And so it's been really exciting, intimidating. The first stage was all, I was very, very kind of imprisoned by the idea that people would come along expecting a very, very traditional version. Now, it is a traditional version, I haven't changed the story, but what I've tried to do is actually go back, I've watched lots of the adaptations, to go back to the actual text and to try and work out what these characters really are, especially Elizabeth, who's become really watered down in a lot of versions. Like, she is supposed to be as improper as the rest of her family. She is kind of created by them. She is supposed to be rude, but she's been made a bit too nice, I think. So it's going back to that.
So not nice at all?
Well, she is nice at all. She's utterly charming, but she's not of her time. She's slightly, your grandfather would be turning in his grave that you were going to marry her. It has to be that, otherwise nothing Darcy says makes sense.
Yeah, and it's called a comic adaptation. What exactly does that mean?
Well, again, it's going back to the jokes in the text, and actually some of the adaptations have done it fantastically, like with Mrs. Bennet and Mr. Collins, you have these, and what's her name, the aunt, Lady Catherine, she's such a funny character, and actually she was the one I started with when I was adapting, because it's such a brilliant comic trope. No matter what anyone says, she gives them advice on how to do it. And I love that. I love it that it's a female character. I love it because it's power. Actually, this world isn't more about gender. It's about economics. If you don't have money, you have nothing. You are reliant on other people. When I was rereading it, thinking of adapting it, I felt, what are these women? They just want to get married. These parents just want to get married. This world is awful. I can understand why Darcy doesn't want to be part of it. And but Lady Catherine, yeah, she's hysterical. Like, this is how you pack your suitcase. This is how you do this, and things that she has no knowledge of. This is how you find a wife. Like, she, it's just brilliant.
And were you kind of a long-standing fan of Jane Austen and her work? And did you kind of do lots of research into it?
I've had to do lots of research, and I've really enjoyed doing the research, because no, I'm not. I'm not someone who was like, oh, Austen's in my top three authors. I did an English degree and I avoided Victorians altogether because I'm a snob. No, because I really liked 17th century literature, and then I really liked modern literature. And I found, and I was very wrong, but I thought, oh, Victorian, it's all a bit wordy and a bit repressed and a bit countrysidey. And then it was after university that I was living with my best friend from university. I was living with her, and I think I read Sense and Sensibility first. And I was like, oh my God, why does no one ever talk about how funny Jane Austen is? And she just like rolled her eyes at me. It's like, that's all they ever say. That's all they ever say is how funny she is.
So as a kind of comedy professional, how do you think Jane Austen's humour works? What is it about it?
The main thing with all comedy is truth, and that's a very cliche thing to say. The characters she creates are very real, so you never feel like, oh, she's trying to make me laugh. You actually, what you think is, that is exactly how that person would respond in that scenario, and it's so unavoidable, and it's so embarrassing, or it's so... I love comedy, most people do, love comedy that kind of shows you a bit of the world, kind of highlighted, magnified, and that's what she very often does. Mr. Collins, who's only, bless him, like 25, and this little man who's just so desperate, he thinks he's so good at compliments and he's so bad at them. And again, that's all you need for a character to be hysterical, because that will come back wherever you put him, whether it's a ball where he thinks Darcy should be so pleased to meet him, or it's that Lady Catherine's complimenting her on her dinner. The way he thinks he's brilliant with women and he's utterly failing is really great.
So what was your strategy with adapting such a sort of obviously well-beloved text?
First of all, it was trying to find a rhythm. I knew I wanted to have that before the second half. I wanted the first half to be absolutely pulling Lizzie and Darcy apart, because everyone knows they get together. It's an unavoidable thing. Things that you haven't seen, like Thelma and Louise, you know how it ends. Pride and Prejudice, you know how it ends, even if you know nothing else. And I wanted it to be that if we say it's a comic feminist production, that they're going to go into the interval going, oh my God, they're not going to get together. Because they shouldn't. They shouldn't. Absolutely, there's a point where you know all of these things about what he's done to Wickham and how he's behaved to her and the things he says about her and how rude he's been about her family. You should absolutely not want them to get together. And you should go, actually, I don't see how they could get together now. It's impossible. And so the second half, I wanted it to be pacey. And then suddenly, with all of these revelations, it's that way. And in psychology, there's these brilliant experiments where they show that if you dislike someone and then grow to like them, you like them more than if you had liked them all along. And it's pretty interesting. A lot of that's happening in politics and stuff at the moment. And it's very similar. If you like someone and then dislike them, you then dislike them a lot more than if you had disliked them all along. When we turn, we kind of have more powerful, passionate feelings in that born-again way. And I want that to happen for the audience with Darcy. When we realise what a good man he is, and it's really interesting. I'm reading a lot of modern writers writing about him. There was a lot in The Guardian, actually. There was a really brilliant article where someone was talking about the fact that he's a depressive, but it's an undiagnosed depressive because it's a different time. But actually, it's really interesting when you think of him that way. And suddenly, when his morality makes sense and becomes the structure that kind of saves the Bennet family, then I think you just have to love him so much. So you really should go from an interval of slagging him off to the suddenly just like gripping whoever you've gone with's hand. I want them to get together.
There's also, I mean, you've kind of taken a formal decision to frame it with some stuff from the modern world as well.
Yes. Well, that's because I think it's dangerous to keep reviving things and not to mention how much, well, especially, I guess, and that's something that I focus on anyway, but the role of women, that we're talking about a time. This isn't really a romance. This is a story about some women that are going to be homeless and be unable to feed themselves unless they attach themselves to a man. They're already attached via their father, the Bennets, and then, of course, you have their friend, Charlotte. Charlotte's, for me, is a tragic story where she, to get property and a small amount of, basically marries an awful Mr. Collins that she doesn't love and doesn't fancy. And it's a sexless story, obviously. It's about love and romance, but when it's absent, I really found it really shocking, knowing a bit more now about the fact that, well, just how precarious a female position is. And I think it's a bit dangerous to kind of to keep reviving stories where women are infantilized without at least commenting on it. And it was either I was going to go on stage and lecture everyone, or we had a little, just some flash forwards to, yeah, to things like, I mean, I wonder what it is like if you're a 14-year-old girl studying this book now. Because I do think, you do think, well, corsets and falling over, and we're past that, aren't we? And I want to hear stories where women, Lizzie is active, it's just that in the book, she goes for a long walk. And then that's the sign of, like, well, she did, she walks for 2.5 miles, and she wouldn't, and that's the thing, it's a really huge thing. When she turns down Mr. Collins, she's saying, I'd rather starve to death. I would rather my entire family starve to death than I have to be married to somebody and go and sleep in their marriage bed and be their wife. I would rather that everyone else dies. And that's a really huge thing, but you forget because of, obviously, because it feels historical, and then that can be made to be a bit romantic. I wanted a bit more of that coarseness back in it.
I guess the other thing you've done is that you've given us some scenes that are in the book, but from a different perspective, a different angle.
Oh, have I? Have I? I think I am a woman, and there is a lot of discussion of the role of a woman in the book, and it's actually very interesting. Whether it's a feminist book or not is an interesting discussion, because I think you can absolutely soundly argue yes and no to it. But Darcy has some really interesting comments in the book that I wanted to make sure that were in the play about the role of women. The reason he likes Lizzie is because she does not conform. There's something else. She isn't just playing piano really, really well and speaking French. There's this other thing about her, the spirit, which actually seems for me like a... Jane Austen, as a female writer, writing from the culture she was saying there's something else that's brilliant about us that we're not getting a chance to do. We are shackled and imprisoned. We're not accomplished if, in the way that we are taught to do things. There's something else about us that isn't being expressed yet. And I think that's what's feminist.
Yeah, you say that it could be argued either way, but when you were reshaping the material, when you were working with the clay, as it were, did you feel you were pushing against it or pushing with it?
A bit of both. I think, like an audience, I think you want to show both things. You don't want to just whitewash something and manipulate an argument. There should be moments where you... And also, that's the thing, with the diversity of female characters, it's a very, very female-heavy book and play. You have the whole spectrum of female humanity there, and that's almost the point, isn't it? Catherine de Bourgh versus the youngest Bennet daughter, Lydia, who kind of goes off and actually, she's a very interesting character, because you could argue that the fact that she's this instigator of female sexual agency is that she fancies a soldier, and she goes off and elopes with him, and which will be the downfall of her family, in exactly the same way of Lizzie not marrying Collins, just in the complete opposite end of the spectrum. So you have Lydia at one end and then Catherine de Bourgh at the other end. There are really forceful women there creating their own stories. But yeah, one of the first conversations we had, because it's an all-female production team, was, does this even pass the Bechdel test? Because they're always talking about boys.
But I mean, I guess it's a novel that is, I mean, as you say, that is 200 years old, and it's set in this kind of very rarefied section of society as well, even. Is that, do you think, why we keep coming back to it even now? Because it's got these women who are trying, in as much as they can, to push against the constraints they find themselves in?
I think the stories we come back to all the time are so perfectly structured. So tragedy or comedy, it's a thing when the characters couldn't behave in any other way. Because actually, when we first looked at the play, we thought, well, should we try and modernise it? We thought a lot about, shall we set it in a very, very religious culture, but now? Because they'd have the same constraints. And actually, nothing has the same constraints as Victorians. We don't accept it. We do accept it with Victorians. They go, there's nothing they could do. You didn't have sex before marriage. You didn't do this. You didn't have any money. Your place was so set. Actually, everywhere else is a bit more flexible. We only forgive their actions because they didn't have any other choice. So I think that's why it's a really satisfying play, because you push against every boundary and then come back and go, well, that's it, that's all you can do. This is the happiest you could be in these circumstances. There was no way we could have modernised it to now. It isn't romantic now. It isn't romantic. If a woman was just waiting for a man to propose and girls were getting sick because it got rained on, you'd just be like, oh, God, I'm not interested.
It's because it's kind of perfect thing in and of its time.
Yes, I think so. We did, one of the things, well, I really wanted to do, and I didn't manage to get in, was to have a much more discussion of about hierarchy, because, like lots of things from those times and to recently, the idea that there's servants and class and that isn't even dealt with. Like, there's a time when I really wanted the end of the play to be a song about commitment, and it wanted it to be that, like, after you have this huge proposal, you then have this, like, the meaning of the word commitment, which is kind of, yeah, committing to somebody, saying you're going to look after them and give them money. But also, it was a time when men could have their wives committed and just all you did was doctor's signature. If you were sick of a wife or she was nagging or had bad PMT, in she goes to an asylum. And I think that's really precarious. And I think it's really, I really wanted to pierce the romance. And also, I guess it's because I'm researching sex work so much for my other project, but I really wanted that to be acknowledged. So this is a time that women who didn't have money had to sell their bodies and they weren't respected, they had no safety. And also, lots of married men, it's completely acceptable, they're expected to use. And I really wanted to get that in. And then it was like, hang on, you are writing a different book. Like, people would watch it going, I don't remember Jane Austen talking about prostitutes all the time.
Well, that's the joy of adaptation.
Yeah, it is the joy of adaptation. And also you have to kind of work your head through it. There is something about watching something where servants come in and going, I'm so used to seeing servants, which is accept it in a world. This is a world where slavery was still happening. And also I've made a couple of things. The character of Mary, who's just a joy to adapt because there's very little of her in the book, but what is there is enticing and funny and quirky. And it's really interesting. So some modern theorists say that Mary was Jane, as in Jane Austen. I think it's very interesting that the character is called Jane, who kind of has this romantic liaison with a man who then gets separated from her and then comes back, which was similar to her life where she didn't get the happy ending. So I wonder if she was any of the characters or all of the characters. But Mary at one point kind of says, isn't there a war on? And you go, yeah, all these ballrooms and this like drama. Yeah, there's a war on at the time. So these are girls, are the most fortunate girls in the world in one way, but they also are kind of little caged birds in another. So it's trying to show the balance of that.
If you're a writer, author or poet, you probably need a website to get your name out there. Squarespace templates are so easy to use, you'll have a beautiful website up and running in no time at all. Head to squarespace.com/guardian and enter the offer code GuardianBooksPod to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And then you can get back to writing that manuscript. A large income is the best recipe for happiness I ever heard of. Jane Austen's near obsession with money and mansions comes no doubt from being forever an outsider on the wrong side of the money tree. Her books are peppered with houses, estates, cottages and inheritance conundrums. But where was she living during this time and how did it affect her writing? Historian Lucy Worsley decided she needed to follow Austen's footsteps to find out. Lucy came to the studio where Richard began by asking her why she wanted to retell Jane Austen's life through the places where she had lived.
There are many, many books about Jane Austen, right? So this is a scary thing to do. But I am basically a museum curator. That's what I do at heart. I really like... Well, I'm responsible for looking after some historic buildings and many, many historic artefacts. And I truly believe that they can speak. That's what motivates me in my whole career.
The places can
speak to us. Yes, I think so. So I thought that because she's such an elusive person, famously, nobody really is able to get to know her through her writings, I thought that using the physical world might be an approach.
And I guess the question of home and the places where you live is kind of central to the novels as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time you read a Jane Austen novel, you might well think it's boy meets girl and she gets the man. But actually, what you spot later on as you reread and reread, which you can do endlessly, that it's really about girl gets mansion. That's almost as important. And they're all about money and economics. And all of her heroines, like Jane herself, with one exception, were in this position where they were expected to marry money. That was going to be their future security. And most of them sorted it out pretty well.
And it's, I guess, something that's widely true of Georgian women as a whole. This was a kind of strategy that was widely applied.
If you were at a certain level in society, yes. Jane Austen was in a level of society that historians call pseudo-gentry.
Pseudo-gentry.
Pseudo-gentry. And I think this is a great word because it means that you want to be the landed gentry, but you haven't got any land.
vital missing piece.
Exactly. So there's a certain amount of make-do and mend and keeping up appearances and that sort of thing. So she had rich people in her family and she would go and stay in their big houses. But she never quite belonged there. She was always there on sufferance.
She was pseudo.
She was. And she was entirely economically dependent on her father and then her brothers. And, you know, they didn't really want her to become a published novelist. That was ungenteel. So she had to sort of pretend that she wasn't. And there's a very long-lasting image of Aunt Jane, as she was seen by her family, scribbling away in the corner. Perhaps, you know, not doing anything very impressive. But secretly, I think she was blowing the locks off the doors that were keeping women like her trapped in their homes.
It's also, I guess, there seems to be a sort of very direct correlation between where she was living and how much she was able to produce as well. Or is it more complicated than that?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. Austin scholars have spent a lot of time sort of trying to untangle exactly which draft she wrote when, and that's almost an endless and fascinating game. But in very general terms, she seems to have written her first three books largely when she was happy and settled in her youth in her father's house, and then the last three books largely when she was happy and settled with her mother and her sister in the small cottage where they ended up living together.
But in the middle, there's this kind of period where they were moving about all over the place.
Yes. I can't tell you how many. The idea of how many houses did she live in is impossible to answer. Partly because they changed address quite often in their temporary lodgings, and partly because for weeks or months she might be staying with friends or with relatives and, you know, trying to spin those visits out because the food was paid for.
There's this kind of debate between those who followed her nephew, James Edward Austin Lee, who said it's kind of extraordinary that she didn't produce anything in the middle, and people who, like Catherine Sutherland, who argue that she was working and reworking on the novels all the way through. What's your kind of sense of it?
I think Catherine Sutherland has done some of the most exciting Austin scholarship recently because she has looked at the physical fabric of the letters and tried to, and the manuscripts that survive, and tried to sort of really date these things more accurately. And what the Victorians wanted, what Jane's nephew wanted, was a Saint Aunt Jane who had terribly neat handwriting and who produced these books effortlessly. But what scholars today say is that, no, she was a passionate person. She was a writer who constantly was striving relentlessly for perfection. And you can see that on the page because she's crossing stuff out and she's scribbling. And the idea that her handwriting was neat, that's very much in the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely. I mean, you've followed in her footsteps yourself. You've squeezed up the narrow and uneven stairs to the top of Sydney Place, and you've listened to the rain beating on the windows in Lyme Regis. I mean, you say that places can give you something. What is it that about a place that can give you a way into a life like Jane Austen's?
Well, take the house in Sydney Place that you mentioned, for example. It's a very lovely Georgian townhouse. It would be worth millions of pounds today. You can actually go and stay in it because it's a holiday house. But what I learned from spending a few days staying in it is that it's all about show and the first impression. Jane's father hired this house like a shop window to display his unmarried daughters. It actually turned out they couldn't make the rent and they had to move somewhere worse. And the entrance is very grand and the first floor's got a lovely drawing room for parties. But when you go up again, things get a lot more cramped and there were only two bedrooms for the family to share. So Jane had to share with her sister in quite a small back room. And from that back room, you realise that the view is only the slightly rubbish backs of the houses in the street behind. And the deeds of this house, Sydney Place, when it was originally constructed, they specify how the front should be, beautiful classical elevation. They didn't specify the back, because nobody in Bath cares about the backs of things. It's all about sealing the deal, getting your daughter away, and phew, OK, now we can go and live somewhere cheaper.
It's all about the front of house.
It is, yes.
And I guess that's something that you see by going there.
Yes, exactly. One little phrase that's a sort of a mantra for the curators and I who work at Hampton Court Palace is that here, only time and not space separates us from the people of the past. And I deny anybody not to get a bit of a sizzle from that.
The story of her life, as you say, is one that makes us, that touches us, that makes us feel very sad. Do you ever wonder what she might have achieved if she'd actually got a little bit more money or had a room of her own, as Virginia Woolf had yearned for?
The heartbreaking thing about Jane Austen's life is that she died when she was 41. And while I was working on this book, I myself had my 42nd birthday. And I thought, hang on, I have not yet written six world-changing novels. And as she starts to get successful, she starts to get a bit of money coming in, you root for her. You think, come on, Jane. And then she dies before, it all comes to fruition. And she died completely unaware of what was going to happen to her life and legacy in later years. And it famously is buried under a stone that doesn't mention her books. And then something happened that's really quite nice. A few years later, one of the vergers of Winchester Cathedral, where she was buried, he was overheard saying to one of the other vergers, "Was there something special about that Jane Austen lady? Because so many people want to know which one is her grave." And then it was boom, she was off.
It was that was the point at which she caught light.
She did, yes.
I guess that the thing that we haven't yet mentioned is the reason why we are still reading her, perhaps, is her skill in terms of just the prose, the way that she puts it together.
Yes, and her particular skill is in dialogue. And there's quite a lot of evidence, actually, that the books were conceived almost as plays for the entertainment of her family and brothers on the long winter evenings. And it's been argued that the way that she wrote out her dialogue on the page, she's marked it like, if you were reading it aloud, we could take different parts and we could perform the books together. And we know that in the novels, well, you can read in the novels, normally when there's a reading scene, it's the man that reads. And another argument about the novelty of Jane Austen is that her books started to be read aloud by Georgian women in drawing room situations. So she was physically enabling female voices to be heard. And the other thing that is brilliant about her, not only the dialogue, is this sort of many layering thing, the way you can read them in so many different ways. And of course, now, as people in the 21st century, we want to see them as coded allegories about how she hates slavery. That's kind of what we're looking for, so we will find it. And like Shakespeare, you can find what you seek.
One of the other things that struck me reading the book was where you mentioned something about how they ate dinner fairly early at Chiltern, so the cook could work without candles. I guess this fact of candlelight is another way in which the way in which we live shapes our relationships and shapes what we can pursue.
Yes, the source of light is a huge expense in pre-electricity days. Well, I'm arguing with myself now because there's gas before electricity, but gas was for the servants because it was horribly smelly. If you were the Austens, you would not want to light a whole lot of candles in the evening because it was an expense. So ideally, you'd light one candle and the one person with the book would entertain the whole party by reading aloud from it.
So this way in which you experience the story, the fiction, is
communal. It's communal, yes. Much more so than reading today is very much a solitary experience, isn't it?
But and again, comes down to the questions of pounds and pence, which
it
so
does.
Animate.
Yes, yes.
You paint a picture, you were saying, of her hiding in the corner, scribbling away at something and pretending, as you say, not to be a writer, but all the while blowing the doors off, as you put it, making things really new. Do you think that picture of her as someone kind of someone as sharp as she was, as bold as she was, but yet still having to work within the constraints imposed around her, do you think that feeling is part of the reason why her work is so widely read still today?
I need to put a great big fat footnote underneath everything I've said about Jane Austen, which is that she is endlessly flexible. You can read her work in 100 different ways, and people have. And the reason that she stands up to the test of time is because, you know, there are slightly bonkers right-wing people in America who are still reading her as a very conservative writer. I read her as somebody who I admire, would aspire to be a bit like, but, you know, I'm not objective as a historian. I don't believe that there's such a thing as an objective historian. I think what you got to do is take your prejudices and put them out there on the table. So I say, I love Jane Austen and I worship her and this is my love letter to her.
Absolutely. But I'm just wondering if that picture that you paint of her as working within these constraints and yet hoping to do something new, trying to actually genuinely change how fiction could be written and read, whether that's one of the reasons why today, with, again, constraints around us all, but especially around women still, whether that's one of the reasons why she still touches
us. She appeals, yeah. That's definitely why she appeals to me. I like to think of her as being like a secret agent working away within the system to make things better. But someone else talking to you in 10 years' time might well say something different.
Lucy Worsley was talking to Richard Lee. Jane Austen at Home, a biography, is out now with Hodder and Stoughton. Sarah Pascoe's stage adaptation of Pride and Prejudice will be at Nottingham Playhouse from the 15th to the 30th of September and the York Theatre Royal from the 4th to the 14th of October.
Next week on the podcast, Claire goes on the trail of two of the neglected greats of African-American culture. One is a singer, actor and political activist, Paul Robeson, who is being brought back to life with a new biography. And the other is a novel, Mumbo Jumbo, which was described as one of the 500 most important books in the Western canon when it was published in 1972. As Penguin Classics issue a 45th anniversary edition of this wild Afrofuturist classic, we talk to its author, Ishmael Reed.
The Guardian has a lot of wonderful podcasts on politics, science, technology, global development and beyond. To have a listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts. Which is where, of course, you'll find us too. Just start up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Tresillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.